It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, the NIH tells researchers to stop a gender bias in studies of drugs and other treatments.
First, the new reboot of Godzilla opened in theaters today, unofficially kicking off the summer blockbuster season. Here's a clip from the trailer.
In 1954, we awakened something.
There's nuclear tests in the Pacific. Not tests.
They were trying to kill it.
We have Rob Thomas with us in the studio now to give a preview of the big hits slated to come out this summer. He's editor and writer at the Capital Times and a blogger at Madison Movie. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what's the buzz about that new Godzilla movie so far?
Well, Godzilla kind of, you know, about the time he was fighting the Smog Monster and Megalon, his brand kind of dipped a little bit, but people are saying this one is really good. It kind of gets back to the first one, the original Japanese one from 1950, which was actually quite chilling. And this one has sort of that same vibe, I guess. It sounds like they've finally done it right.
And it sounds like, at least from what I've read, you've got monster versus monster battles, and everyone likes those.
See, that sounds totally sweet. I hadn't heard that, but that would be great, because at some point, you can only step on so many buses. You know, you need something to do,
right.
So you need another monster to fight. So, and Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad is in it, and the guy who directed it only directed one low-budget monster movie called Monsters, and so it's quite a big assignment for him, but so far that's looking kind of like the big movie this summer, I think.
What is it about Godzilla that puts him among the King Kongs of the world, but you know, you don't see the Gamoras or Mothras coming back again and again like that?
Well, Gamora was a turtle, so that's a strike against him right there.
Or four.
Right. I don't know. I think, you know, there's something about this giant lizard wreaking havoc, and you know, he became cute and cuddly in the 70s, and then there was that really bad movie in the 90s, and you know, special effects that have advanced to the part where it can just be a completely amazing experience. Of course, it's in 3D, of course it's on the IMAX screens, so you know, it's Godzilla's time.
If that's the big movie of the summer, it's peaking pretty early. It's not even Memorial Day.
Right. I'm wearing a sweater and coat, and we're talking about summer movies.
And snow pants,
and
oddly
really
enough.
I mean, Spider-Man was a couple of weeks ago. It seems like the summer movie season is moving earlier and earlier as everybody's – I think everybody's trying to – all the studios are trying to outmaneuver each other and get that first one. And get
and
that,
not get lost in the big summer crowd, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. Hmm.
Well, there's another one coming out soon, Memorial Day weekend. We have the new X-Men movie, and let's take a listen. We've got a little bit from that.
You'll need to go into the past to end this war before it ever begins.
So in that, we have a lot of the stars who have been in the X-Men movie before. Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart, a lot of the younger folks, of course. Jennifer Lawrence, did I see, is on board now, taking over a role played by somebody else. Are people still into these X-Men movies?
The last one was X-Men First Class was a big hit. And this one is kind of interesting because you've got the original Patrick Stewart timeline X-Men traveling back in time to meet the X-Men First Class one, which was set in the 60s. So it's a very bloated cast. You've got like Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy and Hugh Jackman, of course, as Wolverine. But if they pull it off, it'll be a pretty amazing feat. It's like two franchises colliding head on the screen.
So wait, Professor X meets younger Professor
exactly.
X, Magneto meets young Magneto,
exactly.
And so on.
Yeah, it's like...
See, that seems like something Star Trek would pull. I don't know.
Oh, totally.
And would pull off.
Right, exactly. I love it.
Yeah. I think so. I haven't seen the other X-Men movies. Do you need to be on board, do you think, with the earlier stuff to get it?
I got a feeling you probably do, although at some point things will start blowing up and you should be fine.
You know, Marvel Comics just keeps putting out one franchise after another. It seems like Avengers and all the individual heroes feeding into Avengers, the X-Men, Spider-Man... Are we going to reach peak Marvel at some point and not have any more?
I don't know. I think they got their next 9 movies planned out, and now DC is doing the same thing. They're starting to have all these movies building up to, a big Justice League movie in, like, 2018 or something like that. You do have to wonder, like, how many capes you can see on a screen before you kind of get sick of it. But like some of them are great. I thought the Captain America movie in the spring was really good. So it all comes down to just making a good movie the same as anything else.
Is that because these movies are appealing to everybody, or are they just going for teenage boys?
Well, I think they're going for teenage boys first and teenage girls. But you get some interesting actors, you get some interesting filmmakers. The guys who made the Captain America movie, for example, they basically made like a spy movie that was a superhero movie. And so for me, I think that's the key, is like to figure out a way to do something different with the superhero thing. There's a superhero movie coming, another Marvel one coming in August called Guardians of the Galaxy, which I'd never heard of. I'd never read the comic, but it's got Chris Pratt from Parks and Recreation. Hmm. And it's kind of a comic Dirty Dozen sort of twist on the superhero group theme. And there's like a talking raccoon. And it just seems like a nice spin on a genre that sometimes can take itself really, really seriously.
Yeah, I've gotten, I'll admit, a little superheroed out. And a lot of that is, I mean, no, we don't need to go back to the old Batman TV show level of camp.
Right.
But maybe not quite so serious about what we're doing. So Captain America, you recommended, is a good twist. And this Guardians of the Galaxy sounds promising.
Right. So. I haven't seen the new Spider-Man yet, but that takes a lighter tone as well. Yeah, I think it comes down to the filmmakers. I think Man of Steel last year was really serious and lacked a lot of Christopher Reeve's sort of the comic tone he took to it. And yeah, it's just all about trying to balance that.
And Disney has a pretty big movie coming out this summer starring Angelina Jolie and her razor-sharp cheekbones, Maleficent. And again, we've got a clip. Let's listen.
Before the sun sets on her 16th birthday, she will fall into a sleep like death.
Wow. I've been seeing this one for a while. The trailers have been, they're really building the hype, the buzz around this one. What is it going to be like?
It looks interesting. Disney seems to be into this thing of like doing live action versions of their old cartoons. You remember a couple of years ago, there was Snow White and the Huntsman with Charlize Theron playing the wicked god. I can't remember with the bad woman. I get my fairy tales crossed.
Yeah,
and now got Angelina Jolie as sort of a Sleeping Beauty, but kind of action epic retread. This seems to be the thing they're doing now. I mean. Pretty soon we'll see a Shaggy Dog movie that's like $200 million and lots of CGI and stuff. But it'll be interesting. I mean, I think she might end up being sort of the hero of the movie, or not the villain, which is kind of interesting.
Well, it's told from her perspective.
Right. So it's like, well, why did I get so mean, basically? You know, what have I got against the Sleeping Beauty anyway? So I think that should be interesting. And I think she's certainly well cast. She's going to be having a good time.
It's hard to pull up. I mean, Wicked did that,
right.
That sort of explaining the story behind the bad guy successfully, I guess. You know, the Star Wars newer bad trilogy tried to give us the story behind why Darth Vader went bad less successfully. I think it seems like that's hard to pull off when you know at the end they're the bad guy.
Right. Well, yeah, I think, I mean, it's kind of like the superhero movies. It's trying to take these... You know, what's happening in Hollywood is they're taking a lot of these very familiar, established properties and trying to do something different with them because they're frankly afraid to do something really different. So you get the same, you know, a spin on this or a spin on that. And yeah, sometimes it doesn't work like the Star Wars prequels or sometimes it can be kind of interesting. I don't know. We'll have to see.
Well, we're talking right now to Rob Thomas of the Cap Times, looking at a preview of the blockbusters coming out this summer.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our preview of this year's summer blockbusters with Rob Thomas of the Cap Times.
And we want to hear from you. What movies are you looking forward to seeing this summer? Are you a fan of getting out and seeing a movie, seeing the big summer blockbusters? Why or why not? And what's your favorite summer blockbuster of all time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got John on the line in La Crosse. John, hi.
How are you doing? I am getting ready to go see Godzilla tomorrow. I'm old enough, practically retirement age, and I got to see the original one when I was a kid. And I followed it over the years. You know, that really isn't the original one really isn't the kid movie. That was a really serious statement they were making because they were filming that while Nagasaki and Hiroshima were still piles of rubble. So it was a very interesting symbolic film, and I didn't realize till recently when the 50th anniversary version came out of the original that the version that we've seen with Raymond Burr in it they spliced all that in. That was made in the USA and spliced in. And it
no
didn't
kidding.
Really hurt the movie. Yeah, you have to look really carefully. But you'll see that whenever there's a Japanese person talking to them, the back of their head is facing the camera.
Huh. John, what a great story. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy the new Godzilla. So, yeah, I mean, I think of Godzilla as a popcorn cruncher, but as you mentioned, Rob, there's some depth to the original.
Yeah, I mean, that was, like you said, that was only 5 years away from Hiroshima, and they're making, you know, this allegorical monster movie about nuclear war. I just hope they don't insert Raymond Burr in the new one somehow. I just don't think that would work.
Let's go back to the phones and take Ellen next in Stevens Point. Hey, Ellen.
Hi.
Hi, what is your vote?
The movie that you have not discussed yet is The Fault in Our Stars, based on the best-selling book by John Green.
Right, and this one is it's a tearjerker, right?
I'm sorry?
It's a tearjerker, isn't it, Ellen?
I think we're losing Ellen there.
She can't hear us.
I don't know that one, Rob.
Yeah, that's actually will be huge. It's kind of unusual for a summer movie because it is a tearjerker. It's a young adult novel starring Shailene Woodley, and I think it's about two teenagers, both falling in love while battling cancer. And it's a huge book, and she was in Divergent this spring. She's a really rising star. She's looking to be the next Jennifer Lawrence, I think, in terms of balancing sort of serious and more blockbustery roles. So I think she's right. That's going to be a really big movie this summer.
Well, moving probably to the opposite extreme, this weekend, Seth MacFarlane, creator of Family Guy and producer of the new Cosmos, don't know where he's going to go next, but he's out with a new movie. He directed Ted a couple summers ago. It was a hit. This time he's got a Western spoof. We have a clip here.
The American West is a terrible place in time. Everything out here that's not you wants to kill you. Angry drunk people, hungry animals, outlaws.
How to Die in the Old West, I think, is the title.
I think it's a million ways to die in the West. Yeah, we were trying to get that one. I think that comes out in a couple weeks. And it looks good. I really like Ted a lot. And this is sort of a Blazing Saddles kind of very broad comedic Western. The one thing is that Seth MacFarlane likes to make a lot of 80s pop culture references in like Family Guy and then on Ted. And you can't really make those unless they're like 1880s references in a Western. So we'll see how that works.
Maybe he'll try to pull it off.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah, you're right. Oh, I just checked. May 30th it comes out. I read the date wrong.
Oh, that's fine.
So yeah, a couple weekends.
Yeah.
Well, what about stuff for kids that are coming down the pike?
It doesn't seem like there's a ton of animated movies this year. There's not a Pixar film this summer. I mean, not an official one, which is pretty rare. The big one, I think, is probably How to Train Your Dragon 2, which comes out in June, I believe. And the first one was a lot of fun. It was like a great 3D movie to take your kid to. And a lot of times the 3D is not worth the extra few bucks. But and so that's the one I think is really... that's really the big kids movie this summer. There's another Planes movie, I think, in July.
Mm-hmm. A spinoff from the Cars.
Yeah.
But
Pixar. Those have kind of been like every one has been a little bit worse than the other and farther away from the original. So, but, you know, it gets hot and the kids are bored. That might be worth checking out. Yeah.
And How to Train Your Dragons, I thought was really good too, but they keep, you know, the book they basically took and set it on fire and threw it out the window and ran over it with a car.
Right.
Like it has nothing to do with the book anymore, but they're still good movies.
Well, that's like Polar Express was like, totally different than the book. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking summer blockbusters with Rob Thomas. Still time for your calls. Is there a movie you're looking forward to? Do you have a favorite all-time movie that screams out summer to you or blockbuster? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Another sequel coming out, Rob, a sequel to the 21 Jump Street movie, which was a remake, speaking of the 80s, of the 80s Johnny Depp and lots of other people TV show.
Right.
22 Jump Street coming out.
Pretty imaginative title. Yeah. And actually, I mean, I was very surprised how much I enjoyed 21 Jump Street because there had been a lot of bad TV to movie adaptations, but that was really funny. So I'm looking forward to that, although there are a lot of sequels this summer. I mean, there's 22 Jump Street. There's another Transformers movie with Mark Wahlberg. There's another Step Up movie. Just a lot of sequels, it seems like, this summer.
So we briefly mentioned earlier off the air, why do people come up with original movies anymore? It's a TV show remake of a movie, a sequel to a movie of a remake of a movie.
Yeah. I think it's just Hollywood nervousness. They put a lot of money now in these movies, and they are trying to sell them not just in America, but all over the world. So they want something familiar, even though sometimes it's like, you know, 21 Jump Street. I don't think there's a huge fan base for that, but it's like somebody knows it somewhere.
We're all crying out
right.
for the movie.
Please finish the story for us. So that's enough to greenlight a movie, I guess. So, you know, again, it's like if in some ways it's almost like it's not, it's what you do with it, mm-hmm. basically. You could just cash in or you could do something that's actually kind of enjoyable out of it.
I want to talk about one that will stand out, I think. It's not a sequel. It's a documentary, in fact, Life Itself, about Roger Ebert. You actually saw this. It hasn't screened yet in Wisconsin. It was playing Sundance, and you saw it there. What can you tell us about that
one? Oh, it's an amazing film. And I think it's going to come here probably in July. And, yeah, it's a Steve James, who did Hoop Dreams and was pretty good friends with Roger Ebert, made this documentary. And it's based on Ebert's memoir, Life Itself, which is really good. And it's really much more about him than about the movies and his growing up in Champaign and his career and his life and different things he dealt with. It's there's some very entertaining stuff on him and Siskel, their kind of prickly relationship, really. And then, of course, the last few years of his life where he was really, he had throat cancer. He couldn't speak. He couldn't eat and really reinvented himself and did some of the best writing, I think, of his long career, which is saying something. It's a really powerful, entertaining documentary. And I think by July will be a nice sort of counter-programming to all the explosions and dinosaurs and stuff.
Well, following the counter-programming thing, Richard Linklater, who I think his big splash was with Slacker.
Correct.
A very different kind of movie. His new movie, Boyhood, is coming out in July, and I've been reading about this. He filmed it over years with the same actors so he could have the same people as they aged.
Yeah, it's incredible. I saw that at Sundance as well, and it's one of my favorites of the year because you're exactly right. He found this boy who was six, shot a few scenes in 2001, came back when he was seven, 2002. And you see this kid and the fictional actors around him grow up to be 18. And he shot over 12 years, a little bit at a time. And it's really an amazing film. I mean, it's like
it's
nothing
not just
I've
a
ever
stunt.
Seen. No, it tells a really interesting story about growing up and the little moments, not just the kind of the big Hollywood ones, but it's a really interesting movie.
And it's fiction, right? It's not a documentary.
That's right. It's Ethan Hawke's his dad and Patricia Arquette's his mom, and a lot of it, I think, is improvised. But it's just Linklater has a really good eye for like sort of just natural storytelling, not big moments. He did the Before Sunrise, Midnight trilogy as well. And this is kind of in the same vein. But
Ethan Hawke always does those movies where a few years later he films another movie.
Right. I think he's aging. He knows he's going to age well somehow, so he's not afraid of doing those. Yeah.
Well, let's go out with a clip from another. This is another. This has been a movie that's been around for a while. We've got a new spin on it. New Planet of the Apes movie. Here's a clip.
It was a virus created by scientists in a lab. You can't blame the apes.
Who the hell else am I going to blame?
Guys, you can't blame the apes. Please.
Don't blame the apes.
Please. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
This is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I'm trying to remember, keep score. Last one was Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which was actually pretty good. I mean,
really?
I didn't see it. Yeah, it was James Franco was in it. It was pretty good for a talking ape movie. So this one might be good, too. I think it's if they do it right.
And another sequel we didn't pull a clip, Transformers. Transformers Age of Extinction. How many there have been a lot of those?
This is the fourth one, and I know Mark Wahlberg is jumping in at this time, and all I know is that my local theater, there's a big dinosaur robot, and I don't know why, but it's something to do with the movie.
Yeah. Oh, so there's dinosaurs.
I think kids like dinosaurs. I'm not sure.
Everybody likes dinosaurs.
Yeah, dinosaur robot is like, that's like an 8-year-old just turns and starts walking towards the theater when they hear about that.
All right, copyright this. Godzilla versus the Transformers. Boom.
My
Hollywood career has just been made.
I'm not going to go. Sorry, Rob.
So what makes, Rob, a great summer blockbuster movie that's popular and worth watching, maybe stands the test of time?
Well, I mean, you know, the one that always pops in my head is Jaws. And even though that's like 40 years ago now.
And that was kind of the first one, right?
Exactly, right. Before. I mean, in Star Wars, too. But it's the kind of thing where, like, you get the big thrills. You get the cutting-edge special effects. But they've also, like, thought up a story, thought up characters, you know, hired good actors, that sort of thing. I know, it's crazy, but, like, that's the kind of thing that, you know, I've had that feeling in summer movies sometimes where there's a lot of hype, and you go see it, and you're like, all right, and that was done. But the ones that keep you coming back are the ones that they actually put some thought into more than just what would make a cool trailer.
Right. Well, that's a good place to leave it. We'll be looking forward to it, and hopefully we'll have you back on talk about some more as they come out.
That'd be great.
Rob, thanks for joining us. Rob Thomas, editor and writer at The Cap Times and blogger at Madison Movie. Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, how to pack an awesome picnic for summer, which, you know, is going to happen sometime soon.
But first, the National Institutes of Health this week called for an end to what it calls routine gender bias in basic research.
According to the NIH, women are underrepresented in clinical trials carried out by drug companies and medical device manufacturers. The result? Women might experience more severe side effects from new treatments, and some treatments may not be as effective.
So why is there gender bias in research, and what are the effects on women? The NIH's Janine Clayton joins us now to explain more. She's the Associate Director for Research on Women's Health and the Director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at NIH. Janine, welcome to Central Time.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, for a long time, getting women included in clinical trials and medical research has been a goal. Now the NIH is saying, and you're saying, it needs to start earlier than that. It can't just happen when we're at a clinical trial phase, for instance. Where are we now when it comes to gender bias in medical research?
What we know is women are included in clinical research that's supported by NIH. And in fact, there are over 50% of those that are participants in NIH-supported clinical research are women. But what we don't see is in the preclinical studies, those studies where we're looking to test a drug or a procedure or a treatment to see if it might be useful, what we're seeing is that we don't see males and females there, and scientists don't look routinely for differences between males and females because it's sort of like a blind spot for them.
So what is the idea here, then, that most of the trials, or certainly if we go back to the animal research phase where a lot of this research starts, that it's all male animals, and is the idea then that, you know, a male is similar enough to a female that it's not necessary to include females?
Unfortunately, there are some people who think that, and there are also some people who think incorrectly that including animals, female animals, will cause variability in their research experiments and it will disrupt their experiments. We show in our paper, citing a meta-analysis, a collection of multiple studies, in fact, that is just not true. Males and females are no more variable than males, and in fact, in these animal studies, males have more variability than females in certain traits.
And one of the things I understand that researchers are worried about is adjusting for hormone cycles in females.
Exactly. That's what they think causes the variability. And this study nicely showed even when you don't account for the cycle, the females in these studies, the female rodents, were no more variable than the males. In fact, things like dominance behaviors, fighting amongst the males in the cages, those things cause even more variability in the males than you would ever see in the females.
So how does this impact women? So at the end of the road, let's say you start with your research on lab animals, and when everything has gone through its processes, you have, say, a drug on the market. So how does this affect women that we're seeing so much testing done on male animals?
Unfortunately, what this leads to is a gap in our knowledge. So we just don't know as much about how a compound, a drug, or a therapy might affect a woman's cells or tissues. And so when we don't know as much, we can't be as sure about the safety or the efficacy, whether a drug will work in women as well as it does in men. We know that drugs have different effects in men and women. For example, aspirin helps to prevent heart attack in men, but really works to prevent stroke in women. So we don't know everything if we have these half-truths, half-stories coming out instead of the whole story.
And there were some fairly recent news right about a sleeping drugs, a drug that helped women get to sleep, and men that was metabolized differently by women.
Exactly. Zolpidem, a drug that is used for sleep, it's metabolized, it's cleared rather more slowly in women, And so the drug was still around the next morning after a woman took this the night before, and that resulted in some changes in her ability to do some tasks the next morning. So I would applaud the FDA and colleagues for identifying the fact that there was a sex difference there, that the situation was different for men and women, and acting on that.
And there are certain medical conditions that affect women more than men, things like anxiety and depression and thyroid disease, multiple sclerosis. What happens then in terms of which gender these drugs get tested on?
Sure. Too many of the times, despite the fact that a condition is more common in women than men, the animal studies that are being performed by the scientists still use predominantly male animal models. So despite the fact that, as you mentioned, depression is more common in women than men, the depression animal model that is being used to test a drug or to study the disease is more commonly a male animal. And even worse, in some cases, the publications that result from those studies don't report the sex of the animals that they were using in the studies. And that's a big problem because it makes it very difficult for other scientists to try to duplicate or verify those research findings.
You know, one thing I'm curious about, I haven't read anything about it in what you've written so far, but as we know, there's a big push to get girls interested in the STEM fields, women going into the STEM fields. And I'm assuming, and maybe incorrectly, you can let me know, but that a lot of these researchers are male themselves. Does that have anything to do with it?
There really is no suggestion that it's related to the sex of the investigator. This is a problem in science, and it's a problem beyond NIH. It's a problem for our scientific community. That's why we really need our medical education colleagues, those who are in the publishing realm, journal editors, our clinical colleagues who take care of patients, and all of us need to be working together to get a solution to this issue.
So what is the solution to the issue? How do we get this testing to be done on both male and female animals?
As we move forward, we're going to be asking our investigators to embark upon a balanced approach in addressing male and female differences in cells and animals to make sure that men and women get the full benefit of the medical research. And again, the reason why we're doing that and what we want to share with others is that sex, being male or female, is a fundamental variable in biomedical research that really must be considered from the very start.
Now, the NIH has appealed to researchers in the past for not including sufficient numbers of women in clinical trials. How is that going?
Right now, over 50% of those participants in NIH-supported clinical research are women. So that's where we are. That applies to NIH-supported clinical research. There's certainly research that's done by other entities and then supported by the pharmaceutical industry and other entities.
Why has it taken so long for this issue to really get traction and begin to be corrected?
That's a great question, and I don't have an answer to that question as to why it's taking it so long. All I can say is that it hasn't happened, it hasn't been enough of a priority, and that's why we're moving forward now to take action on multiple fronts. So we'll be issuing training modules, we'll be developing policies that will start rolling out in the next fiscal year. We are continuing, actually, to fund some supplements where we provide NIH grantees, scientists doing NIH research now, we provide them with additional funds so they can add male or female animals to their current experiments or add males or females to their human experiments and do additional analyses. And we'll be monitoring our review process and oversight processes as well.
Some of the concerns that I've seen raised about these new guidelines have been that it's going to cost more money and that you may need, as a researcher, double the number of animals that you're working with. How does the NIH respond to that?
More than a numbers game. What we're talking about is a balanced approach in addressing these male and female differences in cells and animals in preclinical studies where, by design, those are studies that are done to try to see if a drug or a procedure is likely to be useful in people, in human beings who get this condition, and they're men and women who get this condition. So this is more than a numbers game, and in fact, the best money that we can spend is related to us doing the best science, and the optimal experimental design involves considering males and female differences in preclinical research.
So how optimistic are you, and how optimistic is the NIH in general, that you're going to get buy-in on this and that you're going to be able to affect real change within a relatively short period of time.
Scientists are about getting good data. And I think that as we share information about the value of considering the influence of sex on the data that scientists are obtaining in their experiments, and when they understand the potential influence of sex on the outcome of their experiments, we're going to see a shift. We're going to see a change in mindset about that. We're anxious to have these conversations and to work together with our colleagues to share best practices about how to do this, because I think there is a need out for getting that word out, and we're happy to do that.
Well, Janine, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Janine Clayton, Associate Director for Research on Women's Health and the Director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at National Institutes of Health. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Here in Wisconsin, we're coming up on picnic season, or so we'd like to imagine, when the weather permits. So for this Food Friday, we decided to give a call to WPR's own Lori Skelton about her favorite picnic foods.
And as usual, Lori threw herself into the task at hand. She's been making delicious fare already, getting geared up for this segment on picnic food. And she's here today to share what she's learned about picnicking. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here on this topic, definitely.
So, Lori, what do you think is the perfect picnic food? What makes good picnic food?
Well, I tend to go for relatively simple things. I do a fair amount of picnic dinners in the summer because I spend a fair amount of time at APT. Mm-hmm. And there are some weekends that I go to more than one play, and there isn't a lot of time to put together anything elaborate. So, I mean, you start off with the basics, a loaf of good bread, a couple of hunks of really good cheese. I think we can find some of that in Wisconsin. Some delicious meat, the best fruit that's at the farmer's market. Just throw that in the basket along with a good bottle of wine and you're set. I guess for me, I look for picnic fare that is tasty, but doesn't require too much fussing once you get there, which is why the recipes that I wanted to talk about today ended up really sparking some interest in people thinking, oh, we can get a little more elaborate, but it doesn't have to be a full-out production number.
Before we get to the recipes, the gear. One of the samples you brought, you had a cutting board. It seemed vital. Bringing a cutting board to a picnic, I wouldn't always think of it, but it seems like a great idea.
And it's one of those things that you can leave in your vehicle. It really doesn't take up that much room. You may want to take the knife out of your vehicle in between times, but a cutting board, especially a sturdy plastic one, shouldn't be in the way at all.
Because I've been doing the dangerous cutting cheese in my hand, you know, because there's nowhere to put it.
No, it's
risky.
Especially because you're never sure, even if you do have a picnic table, how steady that is. Mm. And if you've got a wobbly picnic table and you're trying to slice something on it, that could get dangerous.
Right. Well, let's get to the good stuff. Yeah. Let's talk about the recipes. And one that you brought in for everybody to try was from Cooks Illustrated, and it was called Spice Rubbed Picnic Chicken. Now, this is up on the Central Time Facebook page if you want to get cooking already. What is this recipe? How does it work?
When we were talking about doing this program, I asked a lot of people, so what's your favorite thing to take on a picnic? And a lot of people said, well, what's wrong with good old-fashioned fried chicken? There's nothing wrong with it, except that by the time you've fried your chicken and then transported it to your picnic site, it's going to be cold, and it's going to taste that cold, greasy, doesn't always translate well into a picnic. So this was a recipe that was sent to me earlier in the year. Somebody suggested we may want to try this. It's a great chicken that has elements of barbecue sauce in it, except it's not sticky. And we specifically tried this recipe, served it at room temperature. The chicken didn't taste fatty or flabby. It had great flavor on the skin and on the meat as well. And so it's a combination of salt and spices and brown sugar. And that's what's going to give you that feel of a barbecue sauce without the drip, drip, drip all over the place.
It had a little zing to it. What kind of spices were involved here?
There was chili powder. I used a medium heat of chili. Sweet paprika, black pepper, and cayenne.
So it's kind of like a barbecue sauce without the sauce.
Exactly.
Interesting, without the tomato sauce in it.
Exactly. And we had several people who tried it here on staff say that it needed more salt. Now, I admit...
Wrong. They are wrong. Ignore them.
The chili powder that I use doesn't have as much salt as some commercial blends, so you may have to play around with that. The other thing that was suggested, if you want smokier flavor rather than heat, skip the cayenne and use ground chipotle powder.
Ooh. I would like to try that, yeah. But I like the spice mix as it was. I don't like things too salty, so I was not wanting more salt on that.
What was delightful to me was that I had a lot of responses that started off, I'm normally a wimp about spices, but this was a great heat level. Mm-hmm. It didn't blow my lips off, but it still was interesting. And the way this particular setup works is you're using the spice rub as what is called a dry brine or a dry rub. You put this on the night before and then bake the chicken the next morning. So this will crisp up the skin by air drying it out, but it also allows that spice mixture to get on the meat. And I did hear from a lot of people, it really permeated all the way through down to the bone. We did chicken drumsticks for the staff here. And again, not requiring a lot of utensils, you just pick up a drumstick and eat, and it's perfect.
Did you say regular paprika or smoked?
This was sweet paprika.
Because I'm a huge fan of smoked paprika, okay. And I bet that would be another way you could get at that little bit of smoky taste.
What you're going to get with smoked paprika, it's not going to taste as much like a smoky American barbecue sauce. It's going to taste more European. It's going to taste more old world. It sounds like a great idea, but again, you're
so
playing.
We can tinker here.
Absolutely.
Well, again, we've got a link to that spice-rubbed picnic chicken available at the Central Time Facebook page. Check it out. Make it. Let us know how it went at your next picnic. You brought another one, and I really like this. And I've been saying muffaletta. You've been saying muffaletta.
I've heard it both ways.
So it's the sandwich. It's from Italy via New Orleans.
Isn't it muffaletta?
Muffaletta.
Muffaletta. It's Sicilian, and it starts off with the bread, a Sicilian round seeded bread that you slice in half and you hollow out so you can pack this thing full of ham and mortadella and salami and provolone. And some people use mozzarella. And what you need to do is have some sort of vegetable with a vinaigrette in it. The traditional sandwich has what they call olive salad, chopped olives with maybe carrots, maybe celery, maybe some cauliflower. A good giardiniera is a good example of what you might put on a muffaletta. And so you dry out your bread a little bit. If it's a day or two stale, that's perfect. And then you put on some of the vinaigrette, and you layer on your meats and cheeses, and you put on more of the vinaigrette, and you wrap it up. And this is where I think it makes a great thing for a picnic for a crowd. You wrap it up well, and it can sit in the refrigerator until you're absolutely ready to go. And then once you get to your picnic site, you unwrap it, and you've got this lovely sandwich with all of that great vinaigrette soaked into the bread.
And another thing you did that was kind of genius is that you hollowed out the bread so that it didn't sort of ooze out the side.
Exactly.
It was a very tidy little sandwich.
Yes, as we did find out that you can't slice a muffaletta too small. You need to have a fairly sizable hunk of sandwich in your hand, otherwise it can fall apart. But yes, having that hollow in the bread will hold everything. And the one I made for the staff, I cheated a little bit. Rather than use an olive salad, I mixed up some olive tapenade with vinaigrette and then just used jarred red peppers. I also added arugula, which technically is not the way the Sicilians would do it, but I liked having that green crunch.
Well, one of the things I liked about this is it's a sandwich. It's something you can really make however you want it. You can jazz it. I really liked the olive tapenade on that. I thought that was a great touch.
Okay, good.
What other reactions did you hear from the other folks here?
One person asked, so what's the difference between a muffaletta and a poor boy? Can't you take a po' boy on a picnic? Technically, if you're going to have a po' boy, those are served hot. And those are often served with mayonnaise. And I tend to stay away from things that have mayo when you're going on a picnic.
Mm.
But it seemed to, again, good heat level, and it seemed to go over really, really well with the staff.
I loved it. I have a huge sandwich crush on this. Seriously, like, I
really
keep
good.
Thinking about, when can I make it? Is it warm enough to have a picnic? So well, I'm going to say everyone needs to try the sandwich.
Who's to say you can't have a picnic on a blanket in your living room?
Yeah,
well, Lori, briefly, we've got to wash these meals down. What kind of wine?
Well, there is one summer wine that goes perfectly with just about any picnic fare, and that's a dry rosé, not White Zinfandel. That's going to be a little too sweet. But somebody sent to me their favorite thing for a picnic, which is a vegetable and cold noodle salad that's dressed with sesame oil, tamari, peanut butter, balsamic vinegar, honey, and chili sauce. And I knew it was going to be delicious, but I'd never tried anything with an Asian flavor and rosé. Tried it last night. It's amazing. So rosé goes with just about, I've had it with chicken. I've had it with burgers. I've had it with sausage. I've had it with cheese. Rosé in your picnic basket all the way.
Oh, sounds lovely. Well, anything else that we should toss in there? So we've got our muffaletta. We've got our spice rubbed chicken and our rosé.
A quick last tip to leave us with?
I would go to the farmer's market or your neighbor down the road, get the best fruit you can, and then do nothing with it. This fresh fruit is the absolute perfect way to end a picnic, in my opinion.
Fresh fruit for dessert. Great.
Absolutely.
Well, Lori, as always, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your culinary expertise.
My pleasure.
That was Lori Skelton, one of our in-house foodies here at WPR. Next week for Food Friday, speaking of beverages, an iconic spirit of America, bourbon.